This is Ken Kimmel, Shattering and Restoring, Relational Threads Underlying Jung's Initial Red Book Entries, May 10th, 2013. And there were a few images with this. It was recorded on DVD, and the DVD is in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
I'll be considering Jung's initial journal entries in Liber Novus, taking into account four main influences. First section of my talk will provide an overview of the influences of the cultural and historical period in which Jung lived. Secondly, we'll look at the impact of the traumas of his early life. Next, his emotionally laden interpersonal relations and their losses prior to the outbreak of his creative illness that began in 1912 comprise the third factor. Two of Jung's early entries in the Black Book journals in late 1913 will be the focus of the fourth and final portion of the talk. And these journal texts were transcribed into what later would become Liber Primus, or the initial section of the Red Book. So before I begin, a disclaimer. Great care must be taken in drawing any kind of psychological conclusions from historical and biographical secondary sources, including this one. My line of inquiry is certainly not the truth, nor is it the only way of interpreting this material, nor will my opinions be shared by everyone in this room. Throughout his transitions from early childhood to adulthood, to his older years and even prior to death, profound loss or trauma seemed to have triggered compensatory dreams and visions of a sublime or devastating yet numinous quality. In these losses, his world was rent asunder, shattered, giving rise through a great resilience of spirit to the possibility of repair and restoration, the hoped-for bringing of something new into being. His Liber Novus and the collected works abound with descriptions of transcendence arising through sacrifice. His journal experiences and the biographical details of his relationships, when carefully scrutinized, however, may at times paint a different picture, bringing into question at least some of that sense of an emergent new way of being. In my personal view, Jung's losses in the realm of human affairs ultimately had a far more significant effect upon the onset of his dreams, visions, and active imaginations than I had previously considered. They may have been the factors underlying Jung's great anxiety at times, and his resistance to the process as well. Our tendency to revere Jung, the great man, the visionary, the prophet, may well come into question tonight as the facts we uncover temper these idealizations. Jung, the man, despite his great gifts to humankind, was guilty of many missteps, failings, seeming lack of foresight, even long after his work on Liber Novus was complete. So I'm kind of speeding through some of this with a thought that most of you will know most of this. So if those of you who may not understand what I mean when I say it, make a statement and then kind of go on without explaining it, please, at the break or when we have question-answer time, please ask the questions. There's no silly questions, no questions that aren't important to bring up. So in the last section of the talk, I'll bring certain critical ideas into the conversation that may cast some doubt on the unquestioned birth of a new consciousness that's heralded throughout the Red Book. To clarify this point, I've extrapolated upon just a few passages from the text that seem to expose Jung's conservatism and his fear of surrendering to the catastrophic initiation that he's envisioned. These reactions may actually have the effect of preserving his ego defenses against these transforming energies and nullifying them. In my mind, Jung is at his best when he presents himself to us as a humble man who bears his wounds, who has confronted his blind sides and his many failures, his flaws and his losses honestly, again and again throughout his life. The lessons he teaches from that standpoint are the most enduring for me. So, part one, Jung in context to the historical cultural influences. C.G. Jung's theories came out of a rich amalgam of his Swiss folk superstitions, his early childhood dreams, fantasies, and traumatic life events, his family's predilection for the paranormal and spiritism, German romantic philosophy, the late 19th century psychologies of transcendence and dissociation, his psychiatric hospital experiences with schizophrenics, and the influence of Sigmund Freud, whose method of dream interpretation introduced the symbolic hypothesis which revolutionized all previous theories of trauma. It was only after his break with Freud and his own confrontation with what he called the collective unconscious, a descent into what might be considered a creative illness, that his own theoretical approach to the psyche, which he named the synthetic or constructive method, was born. 19th century rural Switzerland was a land brimming with folk superstition, on the one hand, and country parsons like his father. His mother's family, the Priestworks, were steeped in spiritualism and the paranormal practices and beliefs. The grandfather, Samuel, spoke to spirits. Seances were commonplace in her life growing up. As a youth, Jung was always questioning, while his father, constrained by church dogma, had no answers, only blind faith. Neither his father nor Christianity could sustain Jung's ravenous appetite for questioning, the need to understand, knowledge. Jung went to university to study medicine. However, he was well versed in philosophy, particularly that of the Romantics. Goethe's Faust was an early influence. Kant was quoted extensively in the Zofingia fraternity lectures. Bachofen's work on the matriarchal, Swedenborg's eschatology, Schiller's poetry cited in Psychological Types, von Schubert's symbolism of dreams, there's von Schubert, Schopenhauer's spiritualism, etc. Words such as individuation, anima, animus, the collective unconscious, all have their roots in Romantic philosophy. Says Henri Ellenberger, there is hardly a single concept of Freud or Jung that had not been anticipated by the philosophy of nature and Romantic medicine. Nietzsche's deconstruction of modern society resonated with Jung's own notions. What comes to mind is when he was a boy, he had the vision that he fought against of God sitting up in his throne above the great cathedral, and he was thinking, well, how wonderful, God's in his place in heaven, and all's right with the world. And then this terrible feeling came over him, and he repressed it, and he made himself sick as a child. And finally, he made himself say, well, if God is everything, then God must want me to have this thought. So he allowed the vision to take place, and what he saw from God's perch on his throne was a sacred turd that fell from the chair and shattered the church to smithereens. I call that an example of deconstruction. The student Jung was well read in theology, the natural sciences, as well as spiritualism, something that he knew well from his family upbringing. The belief in spirits had been part of the European psyche for countless centuries. During the period of Jung's doctoral dissertation on the psychology and Pathology of So-Called Occult Phenomena from 1902, doctors throughout Europe and the United States were studying this phenomenon. His dissertation was based on Jung's experiences with family seances on and off from 1895 to 1899. Before delving into this area, I think a little brief history seems in order here, as it's proven to be the foundation which all later depth psychology is based, including Jung's. The European Catholic Church, since the Baroque era and as late as the 17th century, practiced exorcisms and authorized witch hunts. Mental illness was regarded as demonic possession, subjecting sick people to endless torture and suffering. Catholic confession had a cathartic healing effect for some. The Protestant ministers with a spiritual gift practiced the cure of souls through confessions of what they called pathological secrets. The Scarlet Letter is an example of that. The Enlightenment brought with it an end to the witch hunts. State-sanctioned belief in demons, possession, and exorcism. Reason conquered superstition. Mesmer, a son of the Enlightenment, debunked a famous exorcist and healer, Gassner, in a well-publicized hearing in 1775. The advent of mesmerism and magnetic healing were the new healing sciences of the mind. In 1829, a well-known romantic physician, exorcist, and magnetist, Kerner, published The Seer of Prevost, the record of his treatment of a woman psychic and trance healer. In 1840 to 1850, spiritual seances were the rage throughout Europe and the United States and became a legitimate area of scientific study. The legitimizing of medical hypnotism after the fall from favor of magnetism was begun in France. At the Salpêtrière School, forgive my French, the great neurologist of his age, Charcot, and his student, Janet, developed hypnotism to treat post-traumatic and hysterical paralysis that were non-organically caused. They developed the dissociation theory and the psychogenic theory that traumatic events could be turned into physical and mental symptoms. Multiple personalities were studied. It was Janet who coined the term, here's my French again, abaissement du niveau mental. How'd I do? Describing complex theory, which Jung confirmed in his association experiments. Abaissement du niveau mental, from what I understand, is the lowering of consciousness and the raising up of unconscious contents that literally kind of take possession of our consciousness, which is what the complexes are. Janet coined this term, complexes. Jung did not. It's important here to describe the dissociationist theorists of the French, Swiss, English, and American alliance of the late 19th century. In addition to the French connection, the British Society for Psychical Research furthered Myers' theory of a subliminal consciousness that went beyond psychogenesis, embracing the possibility of non-pathological and transcendent states of consciousness. William James, who Jung met at Clark University with Freud, felt an instant rapport with, and his Boston School of Psychotherapy were influenced by Emanuel Swedenborg and the Transcendentalists. Their American Society of Psychical Research investigated mediums and mental healers in the 1880s. So these were the top doctors, the top psychiatrists and scientists of the age, they were studying mediums, psychics at this time. It was common. It's what they were doing to understand the mind, a far cry from our what we're doing these days. Jung's own Swiss contingent, headed by Farrell, thank you, the superintendent at the Bricozzi Asylum, and Bleuler, his successor and Jung's teacher, were doing original work with schizophrenics. By the way, this is at Clark University, and you see Jung there, third from the right, and then Freud next to him. Jung's about a whole head taller. And there are other photographs where Freud is sitting on a box behind so that he appears to be the same height as Jung in other pictures. Flournoy's famous case on multiple personality was detailed in his book about a medium from India to the planet Mars. Oh, it didn't work. There we go. That was in 1900. Jung wrote in 1935, "This idea of the independence of the unconscious, which distinguishes my views so radically from those of Freud, came to me as far back as 1902, when I was engaged in studying the psychic history of a young girl somnambulist, medium or sleepwalker. Those now famous seances between 1895 and 1899 that comprised his research featured the medium Heli Priestwerk, his young first cousin. In concert with the Alliance, Jung viewed the medium state as a form of dissociation, quoting Flournoy extensively. His dissertation belied currents of some modernist thinking originating from his number one personality. He distinguished between number one and number two personalities. Number one was his more rational, common, everyday mind, the down-to-earth, rational thinking of his. Bent on explaining away the phenomena through the scientific theory of the day, he used Flournoy's more reductionistic diagnosis of Heli's mediumship as what he calls subliminal imagination. Rather than a paranormal or psychoid experience, Jung saw it more as, quote, attempts of the future personality to break through, end quote. Now, this is a far cry from his later anonymously published paper on the Seven Sermons of the Dead, which were published originally in Memories, Dreams, Reflections at the back, and which also became part of the scrutinies in the Red Book. And the Seven Sermons were certainly an offering from his number two personality, which is that mythopoetic, eternal voice in him that would be quite content in sitting in a room from the 12th century. That's the way he described that, you know, an older voice in him. The relativization of the ego and the autonomy of the complexes are both hallmarks of more postmodern thinking, and mitigate to some degree his earlier scientific reductionism. And what I mean by the relativization of the ego is that he looked upon the ego as but one of many complexes, and rather than a hierarchical system that Freud tended to view, consciousness being privileged, so to speak, he viewed the ego in a more horizontal way, as among many complexes, which feels more liberating to me when I think about the psyche. These and other ideas, such as the projection of repressed material, transference psychology, the very reality of the psyche, as well as the aforementioned dissociability of the psyche, were first gleaned from these seminal experiences in Jung's early 20s. Jung even interrogated the entities in the seances in a way that's reminiscent of his technique of active imagination. It was while working under the tutelage of Bleuler at the Burkholsi Asylum with schizophrenics that he first heard of the solar phallus story from a psychotic patient, which led him to the theory of archetypes and the objective psyche. Freud's influence on Jung was well chronicled. Freud's early studies into hysteria diverged from the earlier Alliance in that he assumed in his interpretations of dreams from 1900 that behind the repressed, dissociated state was a trauma. And that dissociation was a feature of pathology. And at the bottom of this was his sexual drive theory. This was the first theory that developed the symbolic hypothesis of trauma leading to physical symptoms that disguise it. Jung helped confirm Freud's theory of hysteria through his word association experiments that uncovered the feeling-toned complexes. Using kind of the science of the day, he was at the cutting edge of science using galvanometers and, you know, skin testing and respiration tests where he'd time responses to the word association. And this was the really at the cutting edge of science. And Freud kind of appropriated Jung's research as a way to prove his theories on the trauma. However, he questioned from the beginning whether all repressed contents were rooted in sexual trauma and posited the theory early on of autonomous, spontaneous expressions which were not pathological. His rift with Freud, necessitated by his interpretation of Miss Miller's fantasies as an example of the individuation process, revised Freud's sexual theory, citing it as a feature in some, but not all, psychopathological states. So Miss Miller's fantasies comprise the collected works five, symbols of which later became known as symbols of transformation. Jung should be considered, says the late Eugene Taylor in his paper, The New Jung Scholarship, as the 20th century exponent of the symbolic hypothesis in the tradition of the late 19th century psychologies of transcendence. As a purveyor of the symbolic hypothesis, or Freud's, as well as the transcendent function, Jung represents more accurately the type of depth psychology that emphasized multiple realities, psychic phenomena, supernormal powers, the mythopoetic function of the unconscious, and transformative mystical experiences. End quote. These were all ideas articulated by the older figures of the dissociationist alliance. So Jung's ideas really were born out of this earlier alliance, many of them. The severing of ties to the psychoanalytic world led to the onset of Jung's creative illness. This was a time of immense inner transformation wherein he engaged, gave voice, and expression to the inner contents of the collective unconscious. This process became known as his constructive or synthetic method. Given his commitment to the inner life, it was perhaps his greatest teacher, after all. I'll conclude here with Jung's description at that time from Memories, Dreams, Reflections. All my works, all my creative activity has come from those initial fantasies and dreams which began in 1912. Everything that I accomplished in later life was already contained in them, although at first only in the form of emotions and images. My science was the only way I had of extricating myself from that chaos. I took great care to try to understand every single image, every item of my psychic inventory, and above all, to realize them in actual life. Part two, traumatic elements in Jung's early life. It's really cute. It looks very sensitive, too. A review of C.G. Jung's first years supports the assertion that Jung suffered from a troubling split that began with his painful relations with his mother. He was born in rural Switzerland in 1875, scarcely 2 years after the death of an older brother who survived for only a few days. This was a terrible loss for his mother, who had lost several other pregnancies prior, and it may have contributed to his parents' later marital difficulties and separation. Jung couldn't recall much physical care from his mother aside from the normal care and feeding. Perhaps she felt too overanxious, so soon after the death of the earlier boy, to allow her new baby to feel held, contained, or relaxed in her arms. At age 3, young Carl developed eczema, due in part to emotional stress, although at about the same time his mother was hospitalized in a mental ward in Basel for depression, most related directly to her marriage. Carl was cared for by a maiden aunt and a young, dark-skinned family maid. He was deeply troubled by his mother's departure, and he never forgave her for going away. In his own words, he, quote, always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman for a long time was of innate unreliability, end quote. Conversely, father meant to him reliability, yet powerlessness. He did not elaborate, but one wonders if this sense of his father's powerlessness was in part a reaction to his father's relationship with his wife. I'd like to elaborate briefly on Jung's often problematic relations to men that dogged him throughout his life, his earliest childhood. After Jung's initial meeting with Freud in 1907, he told Freud about an incident of a traumatic childhood sexual assault by a man that he trusted implicitly and who he held great esteem for. It may have been a friend of his father's, although Jung never revealed the source. This, Jung believed, was his justification through life for his abrupt withdrawal from every male relationship that he fostered. He would tend to develop deep initial friendships, great fruitful working relationships, then pull away due to his difficulty in maintaining closeness. Ironically, the same fate befell his relationship with Freud. Returning to his mother and the apparent split in his feelings towards her and all females in his young age, Jung clearly recalled the young maid who cared for him while his mother was away and the comforting feelings that she instilled in him. He remembered nestling his head on her shoulder and how different this was from his experience with his mother, in whose arms he never felt completely relaxed. So strange and mysterious was this maid, yet familiar and connected to him in a way that he couldn't describe. He felt like he had known her always. She came to represent, as he writes in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, MDR, the whole essence of womanhood, what he would later come to describe as the anima. Through this precious relationship, Jung may have felt the first glimmers of a distinct yet unknown other that he experienced separately from his mother, around whom a great ambivalence grew. At a deeper level, the parents' troubled marriage, the unstable emotional environment for young Carl, and his mother's depression were all typical expressions of an inadequate mourning process for the firstborn, who lived for only a few days. In many cases of this kind, a great deal of pressure is often placed upon the next child, in the form of impossible parental expectations to compensate for the lost child. He would always be compared to that little angel in heaven. Peter Mudd describes a tendency in the parents towards overprotectiveness that can give rise in the child to a kind of confused narcissistic equilibrium. In other words, Jung might have grown up with a sense of specialness and calling as the child that lived, the one that must be preserved at all costs. His specialness could reflect one side of a fractured psyche, the other being the battering experiences of total abandonment and loss by his mother, which he endured at 3 years old. Once he was walking along across a bridge suspended over the Rhine Falls, many of you know this story, and he slipped through the railing, only to be snatched from death by the same maid, who caught hold of him in the nick of time. He wondered in his later reflections whether beneath his accident proneness as a child there lurked, quote, an unconscious suicidal urge, a fatal resistance to life in this world, end quote. This prompts the question as to whether this terrible fracture in the mother-son relationship was simply too much for a young child to bear. Such a profound environmental instability, Mudd adds, would leave Jung vulnerable to intense fears of abandonment, annihilation, and death. The British psychoanalyst and pediatrician D.W. Winnicott, in reviewing Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, in 1964, 3 years after Jung's death, concluded that, quote, psychotic illness must have set in by the age of four, and that Carl's personality was split as he defended himself. His secretiveness was part of his defense system, end quote. He spoke of maternal depression and maternal failure. Jung's unstable early life was clearly affected by his mother's abandonment due to depression and possibly her psychosis. Although a number of Winnicott's dissenters in the Jungian camp was large, and maybe even in this room, Michael Fordham, the eminent British Jungian analyst, concurred for the most part with Winnicott's belated diagnosis. What the offended Jungians may not have fully understood about Winnicott's psychoanalytic theory, of course, was that these islands of madness that he was describing were essentially a part of everyone's psychological makeup to a greater or lesser extent. Winnicott also spoke of Jung's indomitable will to recover, owing to an understanding of his own psychosis. His dreams, fantasy life, and play became a form of compensation and containment that reflected the psyche's capacity to heal. Sometime in his third year, young Carl had his first dream recollection, one that stayed with him forever. From the prayers he learned as a young child, remember his father was a country parson, he had grown fearful of Jesus, who he believed would eat children to protect them from Satan. A three-year-old thinking this. He would take children unto him at death by putting them in a hole in the ground. He had seen the dead being placed in black boxes and put in the ground, and he associated those men dressed in black that officiated the burials with this image of Jesus. He was traumatized during that same time period by the terrifying image of a Jesuit priest dressed in a black robe with a broad hat walking down the road. He'd never seen anything like it before, and he wouldn't leave the house for days after encountering this dark other. The dream came shortly after this encounter with a Jesuit. Here's the dream. Most of you know it, but it's an amazing dream. He was in a meadow and came upon a dark, rectangular, stone-lined hole in the ground. There was a stone stairway leading down which he descended. A rounded arch doorway was closed off by a green curtain made of rich brocade. Stepping through, he entered a long, rectangular room with an arched stone ceiling and flagstone floor. A red carpet led up to a platform upon which sat a golden king-like throne. Atop it was what he thought was a 15-foot-tall tree trunk, but it was made of flesh with a rounded head and one eye gazing upward. The head gave off a bright aura. He was frozen in terror, thinking that it was like a giant worm that would crawl off the throne at any moment and get him. Suddenly, from above, he heard his mother say, "Yes, just look at him. That's the man-eater." He awoke in terror in a cold sweat. Only later did he realize that this was the image of a ritual phallus, and that Jesus, who ate children, was somehow identified with his underground counterpart, the dark pagan image of fertility, birth, death, rebirth. Let's pause a moment here. Jung's always been criticized for his tending to privilege mythic and spiritual meanings to psychic material. Case in point, the huge penis dream. Whereas Freud has long been criticized for reducing everything down to basic instinctual sexual interpretations. A story comes to mind of the two blind men that hold on to opposite ends of the elephant, and each claims that he holds the only truth about the real nature of the elephant. The compensatory nature of Jung's retreat into a rich fantasy life and its potential to heal and contain him is apparent in Jung's own descriptions of his lonely early childhood. Jung could not share much of his emotional life with his parents, but his dissociation from human self-objects was healed through fantasy and play, where he endowed outer objects with great meaning, treating them as extensions of himself and deriving solace from them. I think it really saved him, being able to play. He lived a double life filled with secret rituals of fire tending, magic stones, and a carved mannequin to ward off evil that he kept hidden in the attic. As he would have put it later, his personality extended into these objects through identification with their archetypal meanings. As he moved further away from his interior imaginal world, what he called the number two personality, and into his medical psychiatric studies, he turned towards the positivistic world of rational scientific research, the hallmark of modernity, and the province of his number one personality. Part three, traumatic elements in Jung's interpersonal relationships as an adult. Two deep and significant relationships rife with conflicting passions and perhaps unmourned loss stand out as crucial personal factors contributing to Jung's shattering and profound visions and dreams beginning in 1912. The first is, shall we say, his passionate and turbulent counter-transference relationship with his one-time patient, Sabina Spielrein. The second is his collaboration and friendship with Sigmund Freud and their painful and acrimonious split. In 1904, soon after beginning his career at the Bergolsi Psychiatric Hospital, Jung, who at the time was 29 years old, commenced psychoanalytic treatment of Sabina Spielrein, an 18-year-old patient diagnosed with hysteric psychosis. He wouldn't meet Freud until 1907, but Jung was intrigued by his book, The Interpretation of Dreams, from 1900. And he incorporated Freud's groundbreaking and radical new method of psychoanalysis into his treatment of Sabina. Scarcely a year before that, Jung was married to 21-year-old Emma Rauschenbach. Spielrein was the granddaughter of a Jewish rabbi. She was dark and beautiful, and possessed of a mysterious depth of emotion, intellect, and spirit, missing in Jung's relationship with Emma, whom he viewed as stable and grounded and the light of his life. Emma was an essential and safe harbor for him and the mother of his children, yet she perhaps lacked the capacity to inspire his fiery depths, to initiate him. Perhaps, too, it was Jung himself who may have lacked some basic courage to bear the emotional intimacy demanded of marriage. From the powerful psychological and emotional bonds established between patient and doctor came the seeds for the repair and healing of Spielrein's damaged psyche and a deepened capacity for relationship on her part. But the turbulent currents of their unconscious analytic relationship threatened and perhaps succeeded in carrying the two away. This unconscious process later came to be known as transference and countertransference. Jung could not distinguish his emotions nor aspects of himself from a psychological state of partial identity with Sabina, the magical oneness of subject and object, that the anthropologist Levi Brühl described as mystical participation. Jung and Spielrein's absolute influence over each other catapulted both of them headlong into an intoxicating, delirious kind of fusion, a relationship that developed and went beyond her inpatient and later outpatient treatment with Jung over the course of 7 years. She had a mystical, clairvoyant way about her, and she was incredibly smart, too, that aroused powerful feelings in Jung. But clear, incestuous elements heightened their titillation. In her analytic treatment with Jung, Sabina revealed childhood memories of aroused, incestuous sexual feelings with her father. In her fantasies and dreams, Jung became interchangeable with her father and brother, and her hoped-for father of their forbidden and mythical child, Siegfried. If you recall, Siegfried is the hero from the Wagner's Ring cycle and the child of an incestuous pairing of brother and sister. In Wagner's version of the German and Norse myth, Siegfried rescues his beloved Brunhilde, who's condemned for her disobedience by Wotan, her father, to an eternal enchanted sleep within a magic ring of fire. Only a hero who knows no fear could break the spell. Sabina, a deeply romantic soul, loved and idealized the opera, loved the German romanticism to her own peril when she moved back to Russia. She so believed that the Germans, the Nazis, were incapable of brutality that she stayed in her little town and she was murdered by the Nazis because she couldn't believe that the Germans could do something like that. She was so enamored with the romanticism of the German. Only a hero who knows no fear could break the spell. So she was a romantic soul, loved and idealized the opera, and identified Jung as her Siegfried, who rescued her from her father. This ambivalent attitude towards the primary women in his early life, I believe, proved to be the original source of the feminine split within Jung. Peter Mudd suggests that these polarized and contradictory inner feminine images kept him in a perpetual state of imbalance that threatened his internal stability. Says Mudd, quote, "On one hand, woman was experienced as an abandoning, unreliable creature. On the other, a reassuring, redemptive figure full of eternal strangeness and wonder." Such were the powerful internal dynamics driving Jung's ill-fated relationship with Spielrein. His relationship with her over the years was muddy. Psychoanalyst, therapist, friend, teacher, and in time, her beloved, as one of Sabina's letters to Freud characterized it. Perhaps unable to tolerate the tension of their fusion, he attempted to break things off several times, but was met with the hell's fury of a scorned woman on each occasion. After her successful treatment at the hospital, Jung continued to see her, his rationale being that he was concerned she might relapse. He helped her get into medical school, and she assisted at the hospital with his word association experiments and other capacities. They continued to see each other in informal treatment sessions without pay. He worked with her on her dissertation until its completion, whereupon she graduated from medical school in 1911. Dependency had always had dire consequences for Jung. And if the diary entries and letters describing their love affair were true, he'd become too deeply involved. I believe now that their relationship was not a sexual one, but rather a form of narcissistic object relations that was idyllic and romantic. I can talk more about that if people are interested at the break. Perhaps he sensed that such identification with or dependency upon the object of his desire might trigger within him the primal terrors of mother's abandonment or his own annihilation. The following example may speak to this. A more recently published letter from Jung to Sabina reveals how the tables had turned, and it was Jung this time who appeared to lose his equilibrium with her. He wrote to her in 1908 while she was visiting Russia, needing her to reassure him of her love, and ending the letter by saying, "Now I am the sick one." It seems her absence was too painful to tolerate. And these letters from Jung to Sabina have not been publicly available. The roles that Emma and Sabina were compelled to play in relation to Jung enacted his internal split. They could be seen as forms of his narcissistic defenses. Jung's need to withdraw and return to the conventional and safe confines of hearth and home, where he could regain his sense of authority and control, protected him from the risks entailed in forming bonds of trust and achieving deeper emotional surrender. At the same time, the concretizing of grandiose, incestuous fantasies of fusion with the enchanted other might insulate him against even deeper fears of a dependency that can bring fragmentation and abandonment. According to Hegel, to be loved by another, we give over ourselves to the other, and we actually enslave the other. Jung enslaved Sabina through her passionate longing and romantic notions of love for him. Out of a desperate need to maintain psychic equilibrium, Jung sought power over the object of his desires, attempting to use her to fulfill his need for that missing part of himself, missing perhaps from as early on as infancy. As the friendship turned to a more erotic and sensual level between 1909 and 1910, it became more unpredictable. In one scenario, after spending intimate time together, Jung became gripped with fear and mistrust, grounded on baseless rumors of Sabina's supposed ill intentions to spread scandal about their affair and cause him ruin. In retaliation, he coldly withdrew from her. When the truth was finally revealed, the pendulum swung back again, and their love and friendship were restored. Was this a reenactment of Jung's childhood fear of abandonment by his mother and his compulsive defenses against the pain of betrayal and loss? Perhaps. As Peter Mudd writes, when Jung failed to control Spielrein, to compel her to play the precise intrapsychic part which he needed, the spell broke. Spielrein's completion of her medical studies in 1911 seemed to be a rite of passage for her, presaging her emancipation from their dual relationship. She appeared to be at peace with the fact that Jung would never leave Emma and his children, and that their relationship could end and she'd go off to practice medicine and find a husband of her own. Very practical. To what degree Jung had reached a similar state of acceptance is a complex question, and I tend to doubt it. In any event, Jung consolidated himself back home with Emma, while at the same time entering into another powerful relationship with a younger, former patient, Toni Wolff, who was to become his mistress in all senses of the word. Jung's replacement of Sabina by Toni may well have been his way of dissociating from the pain of her loss, perhaps the primal maternal loss lying beneath it, but we will never know. Spielrein may have dealt with the end of their relationship quite differently. She wrote her most famous paper in 1912, Destruction as a Cause of Coming into Being. In this creative process, Sabina had finally found a form in which to give birth to their fantasy child, Siegfried, as she described it to Jung in a letter in 1912. We could say that her journal paper was the third or unknown thing that emerges from the work of the transcendent function. This final point will be taken up in the last part of the lecture. Let's pause now. for questions, comments, before we take a break. Y'all ready to start up? In Jung, Sigmund Freud met a brilliant young researcher whose word association experiments provided the real science to help substantiate his theories of trauma, repression in the complexes. That's a galvanometer. This was the state of the art scientific stuff around the turn of the century, and Jung was steeped in that. In Freud, Jung met the first man of great importance he'd ever encountered. Remarkable, a man of incomparable depth and breadth. The two met in Vienna in 1907. Their initial conversation went on unbroken for 13 straight hours. It was like a meeting of a long-lost father and son. And it's not too far of a leap to think that Jung might have been a little infatuated. He idealized the older man, and in return, Freud soon considered Jung his heir apparent, a Gentile who would carry the torch of psychoanalysis to the wider non-Jewish world. But we all know where idealization of another person ultimately leads, don't we? To its opposite, devaluation. There were unspoken conflicts from the beginning, differences in fundamental beliefs that the younger man at the time just didn't feel confident enough to raise. So fast forward to 1912, after they worked together for 5 years. In 1912, while immersed in his book, Transformations and Symbols of Libido, which later came to be known as Collected Works 5, Symbols of Transformation, Jung had the following dream, which he believed presaged the coming break with Freud. He was on a mountainous border between Switzerland and Austria. Towards evening, he saw a stooped, elderly Austrian customs official walking by him, paying no attention to Jung. His expression looked peevish, melancholic, vexed. Someone informed Jung that the man was not really there, but was the ghost of a customs official who died years ago. He's one of those who still couldn't die properly. In the Black Book, the version of the dream that Jung adds this additional detail. He died already 30 to 40 years ago, but he has not yet managed to decompose. So I'll be talking about three different sources. There'll be the Black Books, which were the series of books, journals, diaries that he wrote beginning in 1912, which later became the Red Book, which he transposed. In the Black Book, he talked about I, mine, my experience. In the Red Books, he's talking thou and art and we, and he's sort of speaking to the world in this almost messianic quality in his voice, whereas the Black Books were his journals, which are soon to be, will be published soon, actually. And then there's the third source that I'll be drawing from, and that's Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which were his reflections closer to the end of his life. And most of his MDR stuff comes from the Black Books, not from the Red Book. So he's one of those who couldn't die properly. He died already 30 to 40 years ago, but he has not yet managed to decompose. In the second part of the dream, Jung was in what reminded him of an Italian city around the noontime rush hour, hot summer's day. Amidst the stream of people, he saw an apparition of a crusader knight walking, dressed in full armor and white tunic with a red cross, like a Templar Knight of the Grail. No one seemed to notice him. Jung asked himself, what could this mean? And a voice answered him, yes, this is a regular apparition. The night always passes by here between 12 and 1 o'clock and has been doing so for a very long time, and everybody knows about it. In another recollection of the dream from the seminar in 1925, that's another source I'll be drawing from, he describes the voice as his shadow, who explains that he has been dead since the 12th century, but he is not yet properly dead. In the Black Book commentary, Jung writes, "Inside a voice calls, it is all empty and disgusting. I must bear it." In the first dream, he obviously associated the customs official with Freud, who Jung, by this point, had begun to devalue, at least on an unconscious level. The customs official was on guard against contraband, illegal, unacceptable things coming into Austria. Jung might fear that any of his ideas that appeared foreign to Freudian dogma might be judged as unacceptable by his teacher, and would therefore be rejected by Freud. All this might arise in reaction to his powerful projection of the father upon Freud, whom he still held in high regard in certain respects, but this was mixed with a growing criticism. When he told the dreams to Freud, Freud could make no sense of the second dream, as you might imagine, but he interpreted the first dream as Jung's unconscious death wish to the father, Freud himself. But Jung thought to himself that it was more of a corrective dream in which the psyche was bringing Freud down off the pedestal. The first dream spoke to the personal psychology of Freud, while Jung associated the second dream with a quest for the grail and his awakening to the deeper, what he'd call, collective aspects of the unconscious. He also associated himself with the grail knight. So in a nutshell, Jung was growing sick of the redundant, tired old Freudian diagnoses revolving around sexual diagnosis and neurosis. This might speak to the internal voice that responds to the dreams by saying, it's all empty and disgusting. When he sent Freud his newly completed book, Transformations and Symbols of the Libido, he knew Freud could never accept anything beyond the literal sexual interpretation of incest and libido. Whereas Jung suggested that incest, while occurring in the personal sphere in certain cases, carried a religious meaning and played an important symbolic role in the myths of the world, especially myths of creation and fertility rites of various agricultural civilizations. But it cost him their relationship. In Freud's typical fashion, he interpreted Jung's book as a form of rebellion from the father, which, based on Jung's track record with men, might not have been too far from the truth. Jung was branded a mystic. I hope that I might be branded a mystic, actually. But it wasn't in vogue at the time because Jung still wanted to identify with science and be considered a doctor or a physician and kind of maintain that modernist toehold. So his book was not well received. He soon lost most of his colleagues and friends. He came to realize that the sacrificed hero he wrote about in Miss Miller's fantasies was he himself. In his mind, he was Freud's sacrifice. When Freud rejected Jung, Jung's faltering trust in men at that time was crushed. Freud was his last hope for a male to provide help in reconciling his inner split. So Jung turned to women to provide therapeutic support. You've all heard of the Jungfrau. Truly, he would go to these all-male psychiatric, psychoanalytic conferences, and he'd bring a horde of women with him, which were these brilliant women, and he brought women into the psychoanalytic world. Anyway, let's see. The lack of Freud's perceived acceptance of this differing theoretical standpoint may have set in motion Jung's self-fulfilling prophecy that his trust and closeness with men would ultimately lead to a breach of that trust and his inevitable withdrawal. The more serious ramifications of Jung's perceived rejection by Freud may have played a part in his alleged anti-Semitic writings during the 1930s that distinguished the Jewish psychology from the Aryan psychology at the worst possible time in history. It caused an even deeper rift that's still felt even today. It's a common misconception that Jung emerged from the Freudian tradition, but the cultural and historical portion of at the beginning of my talk tonight clearly shows that this is not true. The two men came from vastly different intellectual traditions and were brought together for a short period of time to help bring psychoanalysis into the world until their roads diverged again. Part four, the home stretch. The initial dream and vision. It was not until his break with Freud and his loss of prestige and standing in that world as Freud's heir apparent that he was thrown headlong into a creative illness to find his soul, as he would say. His exile from the world and the personal losses he suffered there, I believe the relational factors that influenced the initial creation of the Red Book. It is in these early journals that Jung rediscovered the voice that he first heard in childhood, the voice of the mythopoetic imagination, missing from this age of rationalism. Throughout his life, Jung undergoes a series of world endings and restorations, but none up to that point as significant as those occurring between 1913 and 1914. The Lurianic Kabbalah, which echoes certain ideas found in the Gnostic texts that Jung steeped himself in after 1909, depict vessels of light that shatter and fall to earth and become our human responsibility to restore. The world is never complete. With this in mind, I'd like to bring you into Jung's world at this crucial time in 1912, just prior to the onset of the creative illness, from which the images and ideas of a new psychology emerged, a psychology that spoke to the deepest human experience as well as to our time and culture. His dreams and visions back then were quite possibly premonitions of a bloody catastrophe of war, bringing to a close one phase of modernity while ushering in the horrors of the 20th century. By the way, there were many prophetic visions around that time prior to World War I. These distressing visions of death and fragmentation might just as well have been Psyche's expression of the profound and unbearable losses suffered in his personal relational life, namely Spielrein and Freud. Finally, these initial visions could be depictions of violent transformative images portraying Jung's interior struggle with his soul process. Each of these perspectives is valid. Jung was not alone in his reaction to the excesses of modernity and science. This was a period in history where introspection, personal experimentation, and autobiographical dialogue between self and the inner other were used in psychology and in medicine. Jung had projected his own psychic material onto the Miss Miller fantasies, which were themselves her own mythopoetic internal dialogues. In analyzing them, he could analyze his own unconscious process. Shyam Dasani, the Red Book editor, describes Silberer's self-experiments with hypnagogic dream states in 1909, and Staudenmayer, a chemistry professor who recorded his hallucinations induced by automatic writing from 1901 to 1912. I spoke earlier of the psychic investigations throughout Europe and the U.S. with dissociative states found in mediumship and trances. In Jung's own words, taken from Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he describes his first two visions in fall of 1913. one occurring 2 weeks after the first. I use this version of the visions because his retelling in Liber Primus, which is part one of the Red Book, is brief and lacks several pertinent details. In October 1913, while I was alone on a journey, I was suddenly seized by an overpowering vision. I saw a monstrous flood covering all the northern and low-lying lands between the North Sea and the Alps. When it came up to Switzerland, I saw that the mountains grew higher and higher to protect our country. I realized that a frightful catastrophe was in progress. I saw the mighty yellow waves, the floating rubble of civilization, and the drowned bodies of uncounted thousands. Then the whole sea turned to blood. This vision lasted about an hour. I was perplexed and nauseated and ashamed of my weakness. 2 weeks passed, and the vision recurred under the same conditions, even more vividly than before, and the blood was more emphasized. An inner voice spoke, "Look at it well. It is wholly real, and it will be so. You cannot doubt it." Such certainty. At the time of the visions, Jung held the concrete belief that he was either going mad or there was going to be some kind of revolution on the continent. Only later could he begin to think about it symbolically. When asked in the 1925 seminar for his personal associations to the vision, Jung replied, "I could be taken as Switzerland, fenced in by mountains, and the submergence of the world could be the debris of my former relationships." His association to being fenced off from the debris of his former relationships could allude not only to Freud's loss, but to his tendency since early childhood to split off his pain and loss when anyone got too close. Sabina Spielron may figure into this equation as well, which we'll consider in the upcoming dream. It is perhaps the failure to go the distance, to see things through without splitting, when it came to difficult, intimate relationships, that lead me to consider the image of Switzerland protected by mountains as a metaphor for Jung's tendency to retreat behind defenses to protect his ego. Gigerich contends that Jung's writings were formally open to life and its mercurial mysteries, but in fact, Jung himself adhered more towards closure, conservatism, self-protection. In other words, he didn't always walk his talk. And in all fairness to Jung, I think most of us who write, we don't always walk our talk. We may be able to write things in an ideal way, but our experience, we may falter. If Jung as Switzerland fights against being subsumed in the sea of blood by rising above it, then on the psychic level, the ego fights against the negativity of the soul process that can lead to a dialectical understanding. In Gigerich's thinking, for on another level, water changing to blood is a horrific form of transformation, a transubstantiation, like the blood of Christ becoming wine when Catholics take communion. I was writing this on Easter Sunday. Or a Passover metaphor. God told Moses to place his staff into the Nile River, and its waters turned to blood. And still, the stiff-necked Pharaoh would not free the Hebrew slaves from their bondage in Egypt. In the Passover text, the Haggadah, Egypt is called Mitzrayim, and it translates to the place of constriction. Scripture describes how it is God that compels Pharaoh to harden his heart to the Hebrews' plight, and in so doing, Pharaoh enacts his part of the dialectic with Moses. Their stalemate brings the angel of death over Egypt, and all the firstborns are sacrificed, who have not been protected by the Lamb's blood over their doors. These monstrous murders ultimately lead to the Hebrews' exodus across the Red Sea. It is in the dialectical dimension that opens us to a creative third, or transcendence, or the mercurial mysteries of life. In Jung's either-or scenario, madness or revolution, dimensionality collapses into a concrete closure and constriction. In his own stiff-necked ego fights against a full negation, or what he fears will become a psychotic break, perhaps, while managing to circumvent the initiatory descent that the negative may bring. And by the way, this interpretation of the vision is not commonly thought about or even commonly accepted. But let's move on. So I want you to remember this date, December 18th, 1913. Jung's entry on December 18th, 1913 in his Black Book 2 depicts the dream where he kills the Norse-German hero Siegfried. Once again, I rely on Jung's version of this dream from his seminar series in 1925 because it contains more details that he chose to edit from Liber Novus. It was preceded days before by an active imagination process where Jung descended into a cavern and saw a dead hero. Here's the dream. I was in the Alps, not alone, but with another man, a curious, shortish man with brown skin. Both of us carried rifles. It was just before dawn, when the stars were disappearing from the sky, and we were climbing up the mountain together. Suddenly, I heard Siegfried's horn sound out from above, and I knew that it was he we were to shoot. The next minute, he appeared high above us, lit up by a shaft of sunlight from the rising sun. He came plunging down the mountainside, in a chariot made of bones, and I thought to myself, only Siegfried could do that. Presently, around a bend in the trail, he came upon us, and we fired full into his breast. Then I was filled with horror and disgust at myself for the cowardice of what we had done. The little man with me went forward, and I knew he was going to drive the knife into Siegfried's heart, but that was just a little too much for me, and I turned and fled. I had the idea of getting away as fast as I could to a place where they could not find me, whoever they is. I had the choice of going down into the valley or further up the mountains by a faint trail. I chose the latter, and as I ran, there broke upon me a perfect deluge of rain. Then I awoke with a sense of great relief. He added one additional detail in his Black Book, recounting, as he ascended this very steep trail, he assisted his wife, Emma, up the trail with him. So he couldn't fathom why he would dream such a dream, because Wagner's Siegfried was a ridiculous hero that Jung disliked. During this time, Jung was terrified that he might fall into psychosis like his mother, and he kept a loaded revolver by his bed as a last resort. He felt that if he couldn't solve the riddle of the death of the hero, he'd have to kill himself. It's not out of the realm of possibility to consider a relational interpretation to the killing of the heroic Siegfried alongside Jung's own interpretation of Siegfried's death as representing the killing off of his egoistic pride, his ambition, and his dominant intellectual function. Other interpretations suggest Siegfried's death could signify the murder of his relationship to Freud and the last vestiges of hero worship. In the Norse version of the myth, the hero's father was in fact named Sigmund. But could it also tie back to his terrible ambivalence about aborting his and Sabina Spielrein's forbidden yet alluring relationship that exceeded the bounds of doctor and patient. He had metaphorically killed off their Siegfried, who was the hoped-for imaginary child that Sabina would bear for him. The fact that he couldn't conceive of why he would dream of Siegfried is a little bewildering to me, given his import to their relationship. Was Jung simply forgetting or wishing to omit personal associations? Or was he splitting off too painful of memories? Or was the Spielrein affair simply regrettable and insignificant at this point? When Spielrein finally completed her labor of love in 1912, the paper Destruction as a Cause of Coming into Being, she sent it to Jung, beginning her letter to him, "Dear one, receive now the product of our love, the project which is your little son, Siegfried." Her landmark paper, which became the forerunner to Freud's death instinct theory, became the sublimated child of their love. Here's the final and most fascinating strand of the spiderweb that I believe refutes any notion of Sabina's insignificance to him at that time. So Sabina left Zurich, met a Russian doctor, and married June 1st, 1912. And their first child was born December 17th, 1913, one day before Jung Siegfried dream. To my knowledge, none of the Jung historians have come upon this significant connection. I may be wrong. What it means ultimately, who knows, but it gave me goosebumps when I came upon it. We have to assume that at least some of these facts were known to Jung during this time, consciously or unconsciously. I mean, they had such a psychic connection too. If I were to try to amplify my own thoughts about the dream's personal implications, I'd wonder if the psyche could be declaring to Jung the fantasy of your romantic state of oneness, that is, that incestuous fusion with Spielrein, and the offspring of that desire is finally dead. She has entered into real life and married a real man and now has given birth to their child, not yours. And you are alone and empty. Drawing away from these juicy relational associations with Sabina, let's look at the dream as soul creation, soul murder. Like the apparition of the Grail Knight from the 12th century, who has not yet properly died, Jung draws back from the dark-skinned man's death blow to Siegfried, who is also a 12th century Norse hero, and flees up and away from the scene. This reminds me of the mountains of Switzerland that rise up to preserve and conserve the ego against Europe's sea of blood and death. And he must flee to a place where they can never find him. It brings to mind a kind of narcissistic withdrawal. His egoistic will is preserved by fleeing from the shadow soul murder of Siegfried. It could also allude to a kind of denial of the mourning process as well. In light of the revelations about Sabina, it's interesting that the additional dream content depicts Jung enlisting Emma to take part in his escape by bringing her along up to the secret hideout where they won't be found. But Jung, in his waking panic, is far from safe. He even contemplates suicide as the ultimate self-care system that will prevent slipping into feared madness and overwhelming guilt for the crime. This hints at the great conflict waging between his conscious and unconscious. What he is fighting against is perhaps the negation in the soul process, using Gigerich's language, the decentering of the ego's consciousness. We're at the very beginning of Jung's immersion in the visions comprising his opus, Liber Novus, and gratefully, I'm sure, for all of you who've patiently listened to my ramblings, we've come to the end. I hope I've provided ample evidence of the personal and relational layer essential to a fuller understanding of what precipitated Jung's dreams and visions from his Red Book, at least in the early going. In so doing, I hope I have presented Jung the man in context to his time, culture, and to some of the people who loved him and who he loved, albeit not without often great struggle. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.